Heat, light, water, and nitrogen. Put them together and you get lakes and ponds that are choked with plant growth. This hour, pond scum and other challenges. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Alan Patillo, Iowa State University Extension Fisheries and Aquaculture Specialist, is here. We'll talk about aquatic plant management. Then later in the hour, ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh will be here to answer your questions about plants and trees. Email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and now that warm temperatures have finally arrived, ponds, lakes, and even some water features can take on a distinct greenish tint. Alan Patillo is here with me. He is Iowa State University Extension Fisheries and Aquaculture Specialist, and we're going to talk about aquatic plant management. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, always a pleasure.
Now, I think a lot of us have an ideal when we think about a pond or a lake, and that is beautiful, clear water. And that is really not a realistic expectation, right?
Not in Iowa, it's not. That's for sure.
All right. So how much plant growth and coverage should a healthy pond or lake have?
Well, what our recommendation is right now is that about between 15 and 25% of the total surface area of a pond or lake be have some sort of vegetation growing in it, and usually that's going to be around the periphery of the lake in the shallower areas where those emergent plants and those submerged plants can get plenty of sunlight.
All right, and let's talk about the different kinds of plants. I mean, we're all very familiar with algae bloom that sometimes really chokes any kind of body of water here in the state of Iowa. But we're talking about other kinds of plants. What species of plants?
Oh, goodness. There's a whole bunch of different types of aquatic plants. Some different categories would be amongst the algaes would be Chara, Nitella, filaminous algaes, and then the planktonic algaes, which are the little unicellular algaes that float around in the water and make it turn green. There's other types of plants, free-floating plants like duckweed and water hyacinth and watermeal. Watermeal, all of those float on top of the surface, and they tend to take all the light away from the other plants that would be growing underneath the surface of water, so they can take over pretty well. Some rooted floating plants like American lotus, American pondweed, several different species of pondweed, floating, Illinois, large leaf. There's spatterdock, water lilies. Several other things like that. Then there's emergent plants like arrowhead, buttonbush, cattails, loosestrife, smartweed, water shield, and even some willows and rushes and sedges around the edge of the pond. And then you have submerged plants. These are the ones that are rooted in the soil, but they are large vascular plants that grow up into the water column like bladderwort or bushy pondweed, coontail, curly leaf pondweed, milfoils, Eurasian milfoils, naiads, southern naiad.
So lots and lots of options.
Definitely.
But of course, a lot of the plants that grow have not necessarily been planted on purpose in these ponds, especially we're thinking about, you know, smaller farm ponds or ponds on acreages. When the plants grow out of control, what is happening? Why does that happen so often in Iowa ponds?
Well, the bottom line is that we have plenty of nutrients all the time for those plants. Anytime you have sunlight and water and nutrients, you're going to have some sort of plant grow in that condition. And Iowa just happens to have an basically unlimited supply of nutrients for those plants to grow. So phosphorus is usually the most limiting nutrient in freshwater sources, but in the soils here in Iowa, that is not a limitation at all. As well as alkalinity is another thing in the water that might prevent plants from growing, but have plenty of alkalinity with our limestone bedrock.
All right. And if you have too much nitrogen, too many nutrients in your water, then of course we can see the water just get choked with algae blooms and all of these other plants. How do you prevent the runoff that's creating that problem?
Right. Yeah. So one of the, I guess the biggest main issue is that we do have a lot of really erodible soils, and with the rainfall, especially like we've been having lately, and the fields being freshly tilled and exposed, you know, that soil runoff is going to go straight as quick as it can down to the lowest possible level on lowest elevation, which is either a stream or a pond, before that water then gets captured and slows down and drops that sediment out. And that sediment is carrying both nitrogen, phosphorus, and as many of the other nutrients as you can, as the plants need. And those generally go straight into a pond. And so that'll fill up over time. And the shallower a pond gets, and the less light limitation there is because of the depth. As that pond sort of transitions over into a wetland state, you know, you'll have more and more plants being able to grow in there.
All right. Now, let's say you're in a situation where you have far too much plant growth. Now, how do you, I know that there's a multi-pronged approach to dealing with that, but how do you create an environment where you're not getting as much runoff? Can you plant barriers? Can you plant buffer strips or something to absorb some of that before it gets to the pond?
Absolutely. They're grass-covered waterways. Prairie plantings are actually much, much more effective at slowing down water and absorbing water into the soil. You know, I believe that Iowa State's been experimenting with some saturated buffer strips with tile lines that are running parallel to a stream bank that are actually allowing the water to filter into a buffer strip before it goes into the soil. That takes a lot of nutrients out, slows down that water speed. Also, putting in sort of a pond levee above a pond, or I guess a small dike above a pond, and creating a small wetland area, or just, you know, a place to collect sediment is going to be beneficial there. But yeah, any sort of vegetation that is permanent in that area is going to help.
All right. Now, how do you deal with the problem if you already have the problem? You can prevent it from getting worse in future years, but let's say your waterway is completely choked. What do you do?
Well, it just depends on what your budget is, I guess, for changing that. A lot of people might go as far as dredging out a pond and increasing the depth, removing nutrients and sediment from that water column. But, you know, sometimes it might be cheaper if you've got the land and the space downstream from that original pond. You might build another pond and just have the original one be a sediment trap.
All right. That seems a little extreme and probably difficult for a lot of people who don't necessarily have that much space.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, otherwise, there are aeration is one way to sort of maintain oxygen throughout the water column. More oxygen in the soil sediments is going to bind more phosphorus to the soil sediments, and that will reduce the overall, you know, nutrient pool for those aquatic plants to grow.
All right. Now, if you want to cultivate a certain kind of plant, let's say you love water lilies, what do you need to do to try to get something that you really want to have established in an area where there's a lot of other growth?
Sure, yeah. You know, one thing you're probably going to want to do is go through and remove that current seed bank that's there and create an area that has the ideal depth for the type of plant that you're looking for. And then, you know, just go ahead and plant those out into that area as mature a plant as you possibly can get there. Usually the earlier in the season that you start, the more clear the water is and the better chance that plant's going to have to establish.
All right. And you mentioned aeration. Can you do something if you have a smaller pond? Can you actually physically remove algae or other plants? Can you keep it under control yourself?
You're going to spend a whole lot of time working on that if you do. That is possible. If you got some cheap labor, some high school kids that are looking for some extra pocket change, you can have them go in and and rake out those pond weeds. But if you're going to do that, you want to make sure and take those to an area, compost them off-site so those nutrients won't be able to get back into your pond.
Okay. What about using herbicides?
Herbicides are sort of our last resort option, but there are some very effective herbicides for treating aquatic plants. But one thing that's going to be really important is to know exactly what plant you're dealing with. So the different types of plants that I had mentioned earlier have different susceptibilities to the different types of herbicides. Some contact herbicides like copper sulfate or diquat endothal, things like that, they more or less attack the outside of the plant cells themselves and leak the internal parts out into the water, and the plants will die that way. But some other types of systemic herbicides, they are very plant specific, and they use different types of pathways in order to reduce that plant's ability to grow.
Well, and I can imagine a lot of people shuddering when I even asked that question, considering that the problem that we're dealing with already is water pollution with too many nutrients being in our water. Herbicides are just another level of chemical contamination.
That's correct. Yeah, that is, like I said, a last resort option, you know, because that also affects every other part of that ecosystem whenever you add those herbicides, because the plants are they are food, shelter, they produce oxygen for the rest of the ecosystem there. If you kill off the plants, then you're reducing that body of water's ability to support other organisms.
Now, there have been plants brought in that look beautiful in wetlands and waterways that have, of course, become invasive species. Purple loosestrife is one that, of course, has choked a lot of waterways. Although it has very pretty purple flowers, it's something you definitely don't want to plant. Are there any kinds of plants that you want to warn people away from?
Well, the Department of Natural Resources, they do have a list of plants that are considered to be invasive plants. I believe there's a website. I believe Kim Bogenschutz is over at the Boone Station. Iowa DNR is still in charge of that invasive species program. So I would check with the DNR before you go to actually planting any plants, or, you know, some of these seed dealers that would provide you those seeds. You know, you want to make sure it's a native plant that you're getting out there.
All right. And do you have a favorite, something you recommend to people?
Well, you know, because my feeling of beauty is not the same as everybody else's, I pretty much tell them a few options, you know, certain things that you can manage fairly easily from the pond bank side. You know, cattails are one thing, or some of the blue flag, things like that, or water lilies, things like that people might find attractive. They can plant those.
All right. Well, Alan Patillo, thank you so much for talking with us, and stay with us. We're going to open the phone lines here in just a moment and answer questions. So if you have a pond or lake that you're managing, you can ask questions of Alan Patillo, Iowa State University Extension Fisheries and Aquaculture Specialist. Also, DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh will join us, along with ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and I've been talking with Alan Patillo, Iowa State University Extension Fisheries and Aquaculture Specialist. We've been talking about aquatic plant management. So if you have any questions about that, you're welcome to join our conversation. Also with us now is ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh. Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
So if you have questions about plants, aquatic plants, or trees, give us a call. 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're going to start with an email from Lauren. She says, what are good varieties of dwarf apple trees to plant, and what's a good distance to plant from the house? We're planning to plant a tree on the south side of our house in a part shade area.
Well, as far as trees, any variety can be a dwarf or a semi-dwarf. They do that by grafting onto a dwarfing rootstock, so any variety can be that. As far as the choice, I would base that on my own preferences as far as taste. And as far as a site, basically it needs to be a well-drained soil, and it needs to receive at least 6 hours of direct sun.
All right. Another email. This one's from Derek in Cedar Rapids. I have some perennial grasses that haven't come up yet. Should I wait a little longer or pull them up and toss them in the yard for compost?
Well, I'm a little bit worried. We had a very cold winter, and I think some may be dead, but I'm not giving up hope yet. So I would say wait another 2 weeks or so. If you see no sign of life, let's say around June 10th, I'm afraid they're gone.
So, all right.
Unfortunate.
Okay, let's get to the phones. And this is off the subject of plants, but we'll see. We'll see if it's a question you can answer, Alan. Mike is on the line in Waterloo. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
A grass carp are a good way to get rid of weeds in a pond. But my question is this, for the fisheries gentlemen. I subscribed to the DNR magazine for years and years and years. And there was an article in there 20 years ago, 15 years ago, that said, was talking about putting limits on crappies and bluegills. And the DNR said, if we put limits on crappies and bluegills, the fishermen will wind up with smaller fish to catch and basically wind up with a whole bunch of little fish, say, in Lake Rathman. Now, that was said by the DNR fisheries people. Now, they've enacted limits on crappies and bluegills, which flies in the face of their own recommendations, and I want to know how they were forced into putting these limits on, because I was told by a DNR director that it was wealthy people in the state that were concerned that our large lakes were going to be fished out, which most people realize is impossible to fish out a large lake.
Okay, Mike, let's give Alan a chance to respond to that. And Alan, I don't know if that's under your area of expertise. Can you respond to that?
Well, I can give you sort of an idea. As far as the DNR regulations, you know, they don't involve me in that directly. But they do have an adaptive management plan. So, I mean, they are looking at what the current status of the fishery is and changing their management efforts and the regulations accordingly. The reason why probably you hear that the fish will stay small if you reduce harvests is because of stunting. If you get a lot of fish in one area, you know, they won't have enough food per fish in order to grow up to a larger size, especially if there's not enough predators to take out some of those larger fish. So, you know, bluegill and crappie can both reproduce quite heavily, especially bluegill. They're pretty consistent. Crappie can have maybe every 3 years have a really good crop of crappie coming out of there. So they are prone to stunting, that's for sure.
All right, Mike, thanks for your call. Next up, Jeffrey in Ottumwa. Hi, Jeffrey.
Yes, I've got a small pond on an acreage, and there's a reed-like plant that grows about 8 foot tall, and it slowly keeps expanding over the years. And I'm afraid that in a couple of years, I'm not going to have access to that pond anymore. Is there some way to manage or reduce the amount of reeds I have?
Absolutely. The reed that you're talking about sounds a bit like cattails. I don't know if they have a fruiting body that looks a little bit like a corn dog, if you've ever seen that. And then they, in the fall, they sort of rupture and turn into some little floaty things that look kind of like dandelions whenever you blow those around. And they spread really quickly. They have a tuberous root system and they sort of sprout up around the pond that way. A couple of ways to manage those. One is to go ahead and maybe brush cut down there and then spray with a product called glyphosate, but you're going to want to use the one that is approved for aquatic purposes. That's going to be one is Rodeo. Another thing that you can do is go through with, say, a track hoe or something and actually dig out the root zone around the pond and cover that area with some riprap or something like that that's going to prevent emergent aquatic plants from coming up. But, yeah, maintaining that brush cut down along the edge is going to reduce those plants, especially keeping them from reproducing during the fall.
All right, Jeffrey, thanks a lot for your call. You can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. Dale is on the line next in Norwalk. Hi, Dale.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, Hi, I'm planting some arborvitae and dogwood here soon, and one of the nurseries is strongly touting this product to enhance the root growth, give them a really good start. I checked with another couple nurseries, and they said they don't sell those products because if you site it properly and water it in good soil, you don't need it. So my question is, would it do any good to spend the money? And if so, what are some products that would be useful for me?
I would keep your wallet in your pocket. We don't think they're beneficial. We don't recommend fertilizing when you plant. The main thing is make sure they're planted at the right depth and make sure they're watered properly during the first growing season. So I would say just keep your wallet in your pocket.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Dale. Next up, Mike in Des Moines with a question for you, Mark. Hi, Mike.
Elm trees. Okay, Dutch elm, pretty much pulled the plug on them. I wondered, that's been a long time ago, of course, ongoing, but I wondered, is there any ongoing effort to reestablish or develop any kind of resistant strains going on anywhere?
That's a great question, and actually there has been, and there actually are some new releases of American elms that are actually tolerant. I don't like to use the word resistant, but these have actually been infected with the fungus, and those trees can actually defend themselves off. There's actually a good publication from Iowa State that lists some of those different selections, but I would stick with the true American elm selections. And I would avoid the hybrids that usually have some European or Chinese selections that could be invasive. But there are three or four. There's one called New Harmony, Valley Forge, one called Princeton. And there might be another one or two out there. But there are some new selections of American elm that we can replant.
I know of a few elm trees that are obviously pretty resistant to Dutch elm. These things are huge in my book. They're 3 or 4 feet in diameter, and they litter the streets, if you want to say that, with seeds. And I wonder, what are the chances of propagating from seeds? I mean, can you give me some information on any kind of viable way to do that?
Well, the challenge, Mike, is that there's a lot of hybridization that goes on, so they're not always going to be true to that seed. So you could plant them, but you may not be getting the true parent plant of that particular tree. The other thing that I've noticed is we do have American elms still out there that seem to be, again, fairly tolerant. But with that said, I've watched trees that have been alive for years, and all of a sudden one summer they will get Dutch elm disease and that tree will die. For one reason or another, either it was lucky that it survived or it had some tolerance, but then maybe we had drought stress or something like that, it became more susceptible. But usually they're not going to be pure to seed. So you can plant those, but you're not going to get probably the true characteristics of that tolerance.
All right, Mike, thank you so much for your call. And let's get to an email question. This is from another Mike, Mike and Milo. I've been restoring an abandoned pond and successfully keeping duckweed down. I now have subsurface filament algae. Pond watershed does include a farm field that drains through a ditch culvert. It runs through about 300 yards of shrub area. How can I improve this area to better mitigate nitrates?
Oh, goodness. All right. One of the things that I'd mentioned earlier was that you can run your water through sort of a pre-filter pond staging area in order to just provide that wetland habitat in order to filter that water before it then goes into your pond. That's one thing that I would really do. You know, a lot of times in areas that have duckweed, it'll be in a pond that's down in a valley that's very protected from the wind. A lot of trees around. The wind action actually pushes duckweed over to the edge of the pond and opens up the surface to allow more light in for other plants to sort of take over and compete with them for nutrients. So that might be something that's going on there as well.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. And Barbara is on the line in Ames at 866-780-9100. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I have a question about what I think is a volunteer maple tree. And it was going along just great, really quite attractive. And I think a squirrel bit the top off of it. Is it worth keeping around, or should I just cut it off?
I would actually wait, Barbara, because a lot of times, depending what structure is left, a lot of times it'll break a new bud, and you may be able to force that as a leader. So I would just wait to see what happens. And sometimes if you just take a little stake or a little pole and put it up against that new shoot coming out and just tie it gently and kind of force it up, you might be able to, if you really like that little tree, you might be able to develop a new leader.
Okay, I'll do that. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for your call. And, you know, it's quite a drive to Ames from here, but I have about, 35 volunteer maple
she
trees
can come
I could
get.
Share. Right? So if you're interested, give me a ring. Right. All right. Next up, Barb is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Barb.
Hi. I have a question about dog urine on grass. I have a situation where my dog has to be on a tether. I don't have a fence. And so the preponderance of places that he goes to the bathroom are all in one area, mm-hmm. and it seems like it's burning the grass. Is there something that I can do to mitigate this?
Boy, not much. Basically, the urine burns the grass. It's high nitrogen. It burns it. It basically destroys it. There's really no way to prevent that unless you were to follow the dog and very quickly wash the grass off with water, which is not very practical.
Which probably would be less useful than just taking the dog out on a lead into a
yes.
different area, right?
It'd be fun to watch, though.
It would be.
okay,
the neighbors would love it.
What about these dog patch kits that they sell in the garden stores? Or do those have something that would allow new grass to be seeded and grow?
Well, there's no problem repairing the damage once it's occurred because you have rainfall, which basically dilutes the urine. So within a few weeks, you can reseed, and that's not a problem. It's just the fact that it burns it immediately when you have the urine. So I guess what I would try to do is maybe try to, you know, set aside a certain area where the dog goes, and I'm just not going to have very good grass in that area, basically.
Okay.
You can maybe mulch it or something like that, but just realize you probably can't do much to have the perfect yard in that area.
Now, is it an old wives' tale that male urine doesn't affect the grass, but female urine does?
Well, the males tend to spray things in the air, and the females squat, so the females typically cause the most damage in the turf, yes.
Okay, Barb, thanks a lot for your call. And Richard, thank you for that as well. Let's go back to the phones. Val is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Val.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Okay, I have two questions. One is in regard to two lilac bushes that I pruned last year right after the blooms had all died or been picked. And this year I noticed half of each bush seems not to be blooming. One side seems to be blooming pretty good, and the other side may have just like two blooms on that side.
Right. Because of the stressful summer we had last year, that may have affected growth as far as the regrowth. And maybe that inhibited flower formation or development, so that may be a factor. But I would think that given a full year to recover, then it should bloom well next spring.
Okay, thank you. Also, I notice around town there are several houses that have flowering potted plants down their front staircase, and I really like the way that looks. However, my house faces south, and it's up on an embankment, and there's no real shadiness mm-hmm. on that side of the house from trees or other buildings. I was wondering, is there any kind of flowering plant that I could use that would really tolerate that high heat and exposure to sun?
Oh, I would try things like the moss rose, the portulaca. You could try marigolds and zinnias, salvia. They should be fairly tolerant and still very pretty.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Val. And you can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here is a question from Laura in Fort Dodge. I have nice soft grass in most of my yard, but I noticed that crabgrass is starting to creep farther and farther into the yard from one corner in a triangle shape, and it's covering more ground than it did last year. How do I stop it, and how do I get rid of it and get my soft grass back?
Well, if you're seeing it right now, it's not crabgrass, because crabgrass is an annual grass, and because of the cool spring this year, we're not seeing it yet. So if you're seeing something now already, it's probably something like broom grass or quack grass, and those are perennial grasses, and they come up from the roots and rhizomes. They are very, very hard to eliminate because they come up from these underground stems or rhizomes. And you have to destroy the entire system of rhizomes. And if you leave little pieces, they resprout. So it's a big project. It takes maybe 3 to 4 months. You can try digging. You can use possibly glyphosate or Roundup. But it's a long-term project.
All right. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. You can join the conversation with me today. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron, DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh, and ISU Extension Fisheries and Aquaculture Specialist Alan Petillo. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Horticulture Day. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me, DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh, ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron, and ISU Extension Fisheries and Aquaculture Specialist Alan Petillo, and they are here to answer your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And here's a question from Nikki in Dubuque. I used a fertilizer crabgrass preventer on my lawn about 4 weeks ago. I have some areas of weeds that look like clover and some other weeds that I think might be spurge. Anyway, I'm wondering what I could put down to get rid of those and when I can do it.
Well, as far as the broadleaf weeds, things like dandelions, plantain, clover, typically I suggest waiting and doing it in the fall. Sometime between late September, early November. In the fall, we tend to get much better control than in the spring, and just apply your typical broadleaf herbicide.
All right, and let's go to the phones. Chris is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I have a question about holly. I have a small bush at about 3 square feet, and it's always stayed nice and green through the winter. And this spring, the leaves are all just rust colored.
Mm-hmm. Right. Again, we had a very difficult winter, and holly is a broadleaf evergreen. And so the winter was especially rough on some of the evergreens. Now, what I would be hoping to see would be some growth on the branches,
I've got some new growth under at the very bottom.
Okay. So, but I would wait a couple more weeks. If you don't see any new growth on the upper branches in, let's say, 2 weeks or so, I would assume those portions are dead, and I would prune back to where you have live growth. So you may lose much of the plant, not completely, but much of the plant.
All right.
I'll try that.
Chris, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you very much.
And next, let's go to Elaine in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Elaine.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, I have 2 redbud trees on the north side of my house. This year, they've bloomed. They've probably been there probably about 3 years. This year, I noticed the north side of both of the trees, the redbuds didn't come and the leaves aren't coming. Now, I scratched the limbs and they seem to be green, so I think they're alive. I was listening earlier, and he said something about the lilac tree. Just give it another year, and maybe it'll come back. Is that the same for the redbud trees, or
yes.
What do I do?
As Richard said, we've had a lot of cold damage to a lot of different plants, and actually Richard and I were corresponding by email today. We're even seeing things like some of the ash, some of the maple are coming with certain varieties, and selections are coming really slow. A lot of things are coming really slow. I also remember, oh, it's been 4 or 5 years ago when we had some really mild winters, and then we had a harsh winter right after. That year we had a lot of calls on redbud. And redbud's one of those, depending on where they came from, their hardiness can vary. They are a native plant to Iowa, but depending on the location that they came from, that you can get a lot of variability in how they're going to handle these hard winters. Mm-hmm. So the good news, hopefully, is that maybe only small portions aren't going to leaf out. But again, like he said and you mentioned, I would just wait and see what happens. But in 4 or 5 weeks, if they don't leaf out, some of those portions may not come back.
All right, Elaine, thank you so much for your call. Jeff is on the line next. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, good morning. I got a question. I planted some lilacs on a pond dam, about 30 of them in a line. I got an 8 to 10 foot top, and I planted the lilacs on the backside of the dam about 6 to 8 foot down. Do I have to worry about the structure of that pond dam, or should I remove the lilacs?
Yeah, that's a good point. You really should avoid putting any sort of woody vegetation at all on a dam site. I know that willows tend to grow right along that dam, and if those roots actually penetrate that clay core in the dam, and then maybe you have a big wind blast or something like that, it can lay those trees over along with the roots and cause some damage to the core of the dam, and also you know you could potentially have a blowout. I mean, that you may be a little bit safer on the backside of a dam, but I still would really avoid having anything but grass on there.
The other thing, when those roots die, they actually create a corridor for the water to get in and start creating cavities within that dam area too.
Well, guess I have to take them out then. Thank you.
All right, Jeff, thanks a lot for your call. And next up, let's go to Lisa in Coralville. Hi, Lisa.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I had two quick questions. One, is there an annual potted type plant that will be well served in the shade but climbs like up a trellis?
I can't think of much offhand that will do well in the shade. There are a number of plants that will do well in the sun that are annual, but...
Yeah, I have those. I just have a shaded walkout porch area that it's pretty shaded. It's on the north side, and because of the structure of the house, it stays in the shade most of the day.
Okay. So how much sun would you say?
Probably no more than 2 hours.
Okay. Boy... I think most things are going to be very, very spindly. They might survive, but not do very much. And I'm thinking like scarlet runner beans or sweet potato plants or something of that nature. But but the lack of light, I think they're going to be very, very spindly, unfortunately.
Okay. And then the second one is I have a space on the north side of my house where I'm looking for just a flowering type shrub that might get no more than 4 foot wide, but could go up 6 to 8 feet. Do you have any suggestion on that?
A flowering shrub for the shade.
It does have sun, but it's obviously on the north side.
Okay. And only 4 foot tall.
Well, no, it could go 4 foot wide.
Oh, 4 foot wide.
Yeah, up to 8 feet or more tall.
Well, there are a number of shrubs that you could grow. One possibility that comes to mind would be, for example, Arrowwood viburnum, which is actually native to Iowa. It does grow 8 foot tall, and it tends to be 8 foot wide, so it's wider than you want, but it's native to Iowa. It has the creamy white flowers. It's easy to grow, no problem at all.
Red osier dogwood would probably fit in that category fairly close.
Right, right.
So what kind of dogwood?
Red osier dogwood.
Okay.
It's also a native.
Okay. All right. But would that get as wide as the viburnum?
It's going to be in that 3 to 5 foot width.
Okay. That would be better then. All right. Thanks very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Lisa. And next up, let's go to Bill in Davenport. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
My question is, I have two questions. One is, I have last spring, I after it flowered, I trimmed back a Korean spice, and this spring it had very few, very sparse blooms. I wondered about severely pruning it back. And then my second question is, having already put Morlorganite fertilizer down, what would the steps be to put grass seed out and also treat for pre-emergent crabgrass? Thank you.
Well, at this point, it may be too late with for a pre-emergent herbicide for crabgrass control. It's already basically late May, so it may be too late for that. As far as sowing grass seed, it's typically very, very difficult, if not impossible, to sow grass seed successfully from basically late May to mid-August. So I would wait as far as sowing grass seed until late August or so, and then you should have pretty good luck. So, but doing it right now, it's getting too late for that. So pre-emergent herbicide typically goes on sometime in April, early May in Iowa, and the best time to sow grass seed would be basically late summer.
All right, Bill, thanks a lot for your call. We have time for a couple more questions at 866-780-9100. Here's an email from Eva. I have a 10-year-old swamp oak with 8 seedling offspring growing at the base of the tree that are now 3 years old. I'd like to move them this year. Would it be best to dig and transplant in spring or fall? How much of the root do I need to dig up? With 8 seedlings, am I going to damage the existing tree? And what's the likely success rate for the transplants?
Well, the thing that she needs to make sure is that those seedlings are not coming from the base. If they're actually coming from the base, I would not try to transplant them because they're probably attached. So what you'll want to do is try to see if they're actual true seedlings or if they're actually sprouts, either okay. the trees.
And how can she tell?
Well, she can dig around a little bit and actually see if it's connected to that trunk or they won't tend to come from the root. They'll tend to come from the base. So if they're really close to the trunk, she can just dig away and see if that is attached there. If it's all right. not attached, I'm a big spring guy. She'd actually be better to dig them up next spring. If that's going to cause an issue, she can do it this fall as soon as the leaves fall off and the tree goes dormant. And the more of that little root that she can dig up, the better. And in that case, if they're fairly small, she could kind of almost bare root them, kind of shake the soil off, and then transplant them right away. But if they're connected to the trunk, I would actually this winter just cut those off because then they're actually just stump sprouts or trunk sprouts.
All right, and it's too late this spring.
I would not do it. They tend to transplant a lot better when they're dormant. Now, with that said, if they're very small and she can really scoop up all the root and kind of keep the soil together, she might still have a decent chance to transplant them.
All right.
But I would make sure it's not connected to the trunk.
All right, let's get back to the phones. This is Kyle on the line in Butler County. Hi, Kyle.
Hello.
Hi.
I had a question about, is there any effective means for controlling horsetail?
That's a good question. Horsetail, I believe, is one of those that tends to sprout off of itself through the soil. You may have to actually dig that one up. I had a question earlier about horsetail, earlier today, in fact, and I wasn't able to find a really good type of herbicide to use for that, but looks like for different types of sedges and rushes that you can use either glyphosate or maybe penoxalum in order to control that as the way you would spray normal.
Well, I farm, and it seems to grow just fine in the field, even when things have... Yeah, we spray glyphosate and Roundup and all that, and it doesn't seem to ever even touch it.
Sure. The best thing to do would probably be to contact me by email, and then I'd be able to do a little more research for you. My email is Patillo, P-A-T-T-I-L-L-O, at iastate.edu. That'd probably be the best way to go about it.
All right, Kyle, thanks a lot for your call, and we'll go next to Mary on the line in Coggin. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I live in a remote area by the river, and there's a couple residential homes near me, but there is now farming going on right above my hillside. And it's in the years past, I was told by my mother many years ago that when that field got farmed, it would flow sand down into our yard near our well and all through the back of our area and causing problems with grass growing and just a mess. And now I wanted to know if the farming has changed over the last 40 years because I'm not a farm girl, but I also wanted to know if there could be some prevention. They have removed every tree and every shrub already along the field side near a driveway going up to my neighbors, and I'm right next to that driveway as well. So the trees are not going to hold back any water now. What can I do or suggest, or what should they do? Put a culvert in of some sort or some kind of berm or drainage. I have a natural ditch that rolls through my property, but it rolls into the river. So I'm not sure if there will be a foreseen problem here or not, and what can I do about it if there is?
I'm not sure that you can do much, but if you have a ditch on your property, you might try to establish native grasses and wildflowers in that ditch. That would, they have very deep root systems, that would act like a filter, hopefully, to some extent, and reduce runoff, so you could try that.
All right. One last call, I think. Maybe we'll squeeze in another. Craig is on the line in Orient. Hi, Craig.
Hi. I have a five-year-old pond, and it has the willows growing on it. Is there any way to remove those, or what way do you recommend?
Right, yeah. So willows, they have a fairly extensive root system, but being able to dig those out from around the edge of the pond, you can remove those entire plants. Might be the best way to do that. Another thing, in order to kill those plants or seedlings coming off of there, glyphosate's a good option.
All right, and next up, Tom Incoming. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. I've got some 3 to 4 or 5 year old white pines that are struggling coming out of the winter. They're half green, half brown. Is there anything I can do to enhance them to, you know, get better and foliate other than just leaving them? Or should I try to knock off the dead brown and trim them back, or what, or just wait and see?
Tom, this is going to sound like a broken record, but actually I'm going to tell you to wait, because if you look really close, a lot of these are brown on the inside, but they are putting on new shoots, and that shoot comes from the tip. And so I would really watch for that new growth. That's where all the new growth comes from. And some of these that were damaged by the winter, or I actually saw a lot of salt damage, especially if they're close to roads from drift and stuff like that. But again, a lot of winter damage. So they're putting on those new candles right now. And if they're not putting on those new candles, I would wait again a couple weeks, but that growth comes from the tips. So if that new growth is not there, at some point, you're going to have to cut back to what is green. But I would give it some time, because if you cut what you think is brown, a lot of times that new shoot is coming from the tip.
All right. I'm telling a lot of people to wait and see this spring.
Yeah.
That's good advice. And let's see if we can squeeze in this question from Melissa. I have a Japanese maple tree on the south side of my home that took major damage this winter. The top third or half of the tree is dead. The lower branches look fine. Is it worth trying to save the tree, or should I remove it?
That's up to her. I would cut out that material, and aesthetically, is that tree, you know, still good? The challenge is, on the south side, that's a really tough location for that particular maple. It really likes an east or a north, so it's going to continue to have a tough time. So I would remove it, look at it, and if she could withstand it, give it a chance.
All right. DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Alan Patillo, Iowa State University Extension Fisheries and Aquaculture Specialist, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nettie.
And have a wonderful, wonderful holiday weekend. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up Monday on the show, an encore of my conversation with author Ayanna Mathis about her book, The 12 Tribes of Hattie.